power.
You have great power. Okay. We are recording now, so thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, so we are recording and stars have aligned. So Patrick is here helping us out. Introducing ourselves, I'll go first. I am Javoni. I am from Lincoln, Nebraska. I am a STEM education fellow here. We are working on a high school climate literacy project, and it is our third year, and I am very much excited to share more about the project in the future. So, passing on, who goes next?
Well, should we go in the name of using the screen as a key, if that helps? This is James Callahan with climatechangeeducation.org and the Mobile Climate Science Labs. We are based in California with a base in Washington, D.C.
Hi, I'm Emily Corin. I do science communication, focusing on climate. I've been working on national scale storytelling initiatives. We got an article out last week. Just putting up a link to it now. Unless you know me by now.
Great. The links to articles are in our Zoom group chat if you're new to this feature. And you are free to say hello to each other in this space too. You just have to click on everyone so that everyone can see, or you can have a personal conversation too if you click on that everyone and select the people. Who goes next?
I'll go. This is Wendy Abshire. Hi, I'm the director of the American Meteorological Society Education Program and a new member of the CLEAN Board. And our relationship to CLEAN is that we are also in the earth science literacy business, specifically running professional development programs for K-12 educators is our primary focus.
Welcome, Wendy.
Thanks.
I can jump in. This is Patrick Chandler and my PhD student at CU Boulder, focused on science communication and art science integration, and am a coordinator with the CLEAN Network, previously a fellow for the Earth Science Information Partners with CLEAN.
Hi, Patrick.
Hi, this is Jen Kretzer. I'm also on the CLEAN board, and I'm the director of climate initiatives at the Wild Center in upstate New York in the Adirondack Park. And we run a youth climate program and help to convene and empower young people around climate change through youth climate summits. And we also do leadership training and teacher climate institutes.
Hi, Jen.
So this is Frank Nepold at NOAA. You don't see me yet because I'm dealing with some federal government IT issues, but I'm on the phone. And I am the climate education coordinator and senior program manager in the climate program office at NOAA. And I'm a founding member of the CLEAN Network and a current co-chair. And one of the lead documents that for our community is the Climate Literacy Guide. So I'm the federal lead for that and a bunch of other things. So happy to be with you all. Hopefully I'll see you soon.
My name is Amy Frame, and I am the K-12 program manager with Henstrand out in California, which is a public-private partnership to spread environmental literacy, including climate change literacy, through the entire K-12 system.
Hi, Amy. I think Tamara is trying to reach us through phone.
Lindsay, did you want to, while we got Tamara calling in?
Hello, this is Tamara. Can you hear me?
You're coming through.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, it never worked through the computer. I don't know why. So I'm watching all of you. Oh, wait, that's not good. I have to.
In any case, we can hear you fine, or at least I can.
Okay, good. Okay, so I'll introduce myself. I'm Tamara Ledley. I'm also a founding member of the Clean Network and on the Clean Board. The other big news, I guess, is that I was elected president of the Earth Science Information Partners, ESIP. And so for those of you who are not aware, the Clean Network is what's a collaboration area within ESIP. And so we have the various kind of capabilities that I can describe at another time and potential opportunities. It may be worth at some point my giving a 15 or 20 minute talk just about what those are, but I'm just getting my head around all of them now. I've been involved with ESIP for for 20 years. But this is and I've been in various leadership positions, especially around education, but this is the first time that I've been president of the organization. So, and then my other work is involved in developing teacher professional learning communities around climate change and enabling teachers to teach more effectively.
Congratulations for the leadership. It's always nice to hear from male leaders in the field. So really proud of that. I guess it's an informal discussion, but we do ask for announcements. So if you have something to share, please share. News from your parts of the world, climate literacy, how is it moving forward?
Go ahead, Frank.
Go ahead, Jim. Jim, go first, please.
Okay. So let's see. I will send out this through the Clean Network email as well, because it's really an invitation for other clean membering organizations who might want to join us and take part of it. I know, Wendy, you will be at this, so this is for sure. You're already doing this, but an invitation to take part of what, as far as I know, is the largest educational event in the United States. It's certainly the largest science education event. We want to assure, and we will be assuring, that climate science and climate action in education is very much a popular part of it. The event is the United States Science and Engineering Festival in Washington, D.C. in April, between the 24th and the 26th. And for an idea of it, on the first day, on the 24th, 70,000 elementary, middle school, and high school students will be there with their teachers, 70,000 from many states in the area. And on the next 2 days, typically, they reliably get 200,000 K-12 students and their family members. So that's a pretty good way to get what we're doing out together. And so want to invite others to see if they want to work with us on that. We're certainly also going to be extending. We know there's interest at NSTA in this. AAAS usually participates. We want to see they're doing. NASA Goddard. And then Wendy will check you back in too, seeing if, because sometimes we'll be on different areas. It's a huge event, so we might be in different areas, each kind of supplementing what each other is doing. So that's what I wanted to announce.
Thanks, Jim. The one thing I wanted to, and maybe we should spend some time on it today, is Mark McCaffrey's email that came in this morning. Regarding the ACE submissions for the Doha work program. There's a lot of gobbledygook language I just said, so hopefully that makes some sense to you guys. But there's a process by which that is going on. It came in around 2:46 a.m. East Coast time. So you may have not made it your inbox, but It's an effort that ECOS, which is our partner international network, kind of a parallel version of Clean. Mark was a, for those of you who don't know, Mark was a founding member along with Tamara, myself, and a few others. So, but this process is fast moving and it has some details, and there's a webinar that happened today, and then there's another one, or Monday, no, today, and then there's another one happening on Wednesday regarding some of this process. So if you're interested in this, definitely pay attention, because in it, they also talk not just what happened in the last 8 years of climate change education internationally and training and public access to information, but also recommendations for moving forward. And I think our community has perspective on both things. So just something to consider. We don't have to do this as a clean process. I don't know if we have the community effort to do that, but individual organizations can submit their own points, and the details are all covered in the email. Something to pay attention to.
So Frank, I'm just looking at that email, and that is there was one today at 4 a.m., which was, I was asleep. I think probably most of us were sleeping, East Coast time. And then, but the one on Thursday, January 23rd is at 10 a.m. Eastern time, 7 a.m. Pacific Coast time. Right. And I see that there's a Zoom invite as part of that email. And that went out to the Clean Network. Exactly. So you just, I had to go scroll back. I didn't even see the, 2 a.m. timestamp that he's sending.
It's all good. I imagine, just make sure that we see this. But again, the thing that's most, there are many things that are important here, but one of them is that if you are an organization that is recognized as a UNFCCC observer, you can submit it one way, but if you're not, you have another way. There's two ways to submit this information. And so just something to consider. You submit it directly by email and the details are in there. So just something I thought people who spend a lot of time in this space would want to have contributions.
Related to that, there was a submission request for the same thing through a group that's looking at museums and climate change, that they had sent around a Google form that that was focused specifically on outlining the Action for Climate Empowerment and the Doha Work Program, with questions specifically around what museums were doing and working in education and public engagement around climate change. So it's just interesting. I will circle back and maybe connect Mark to that particular group in case they're not connected, because it's the same, it's the same space. It's the same, there are two groups working on education around climate change in informal settings. or specifically, I'm sorry, informal settings.
Sorry, Jen, I just got back. I lost audio. If that question was to me, I'm sorry,
no.
I didn't hear it.
It's okay. I can catch you up later. It's just that there was, I don't have a way to access the survey, or else I would put it into the chat, but I'll reach back to Mark McCaffrey about connecting those two groups. It just sounds like there's some connecting that could happen between this one group that's focused on museums and climate education and ECOS and Mark's efforts.
I believe that's actually already taken care of.
Okay,
from what I understand.
Great.
With Henry in the UK?
Yes, Henry.
Yeah, that is.
Okay, yep. Great.
Good news.
Yay.
Yeah. So networks and work.
So on that, for Frank and Jen, is Frank and you and Mark want to handle, or does it help to have a double dip into the Aztec news scene, the Association for Science and Technology Centers? Certainly whenever I submit something to that as members, we do get back pings from the science museums that are either doing or thinking of doing things on climate. Aztec is pretty much a U.S. organization, but they do have a significant amount of science museums internationally.
One thing you should know is that the Aztec is kind of shifting their focus and being more U.S. focused. Definitely more North American focused. So there, that came out in the last kind of strategic planning effort, from what I understand. So, but you know, if Aztec wanted to put forth a submission, that would be totally appropriate. Or members of that, you know, I don't know if Aztec has enough time to actually put a formal review in and processed under the Aztec leadership, but definitely organizations totally have the ability to do that.
Do you think though that would be, I mean, I want to bring this up in a way that's helpful and not just makes things more all over the place. Would that help Mark and you if indeed it would be, I think would be more the individual Aztec members to see if we want to encourage them to consider making a submission?
Jim, absolutely. I mean, one of the things, just while we're on the phone, I mean, the people here are working on Doha work program related work. But I would imagine this was true for me, and I'm supposed to even know about this. I never felt like I was working on the Doha work program officially. I was never asked to work on the Doha work program. I participated through some of it, but I mean, it feels like a mandate that never made it to us who are working in this. I mean, Wendy, did you feel like you were working on the Doha work program? You know?
What?
My
that
point.
Would be no.
I appreciate that. But you were. You just didn't know that you were, right? When you were at UCAR working on what was the program? Comet, right? Yeah, that's totally related to the Doha work program.
Interesting. But that is never connected.
You know what I mean? So that's just the nature of this work, right? Is that all these things are done at the international level. That when the work is being done, that international mandate doesn't actually become the mandate, but with the work we do independent that relates, we say was part of the work program. But you know, the reason why we did it was not because of what the program said we should.
Right.
So it's an interesting reality.
I have a couple announcements if there's space.
Cool. I'm good.
I just wanted to let everyone know that the AMS annual meeting for our centennial celebration happened last week. It was the largest meeting we've ever had in terms of attendance, with over 5,900 attendees. Sounds like the numbers won't quite make it to 6,000, but we were really, really close. It was vibrant. It was dynamic. Climate science was a huge part of the meeting, and I was really hoping Katie would be on the call today because I think she and I saw each other there, and she was promoting clean in an active learning session we had for K-12 educators. But I didn't get to go to many of the climate sessions, of which there were many. There were 40 technical conferences happening simultaneously, many of which were relevant to climate science, climate literacy, climate justice, climate education, you name it. But I'm staff, so I was going to meetings and supporting things and not doing the fun part of the meeting in that regard. So Katie may have more to say in the future about some of her takeaways, but I wanted to let you know that Clean was represented and present, which was great.
I was also there. I had a poster there.
Oh, true. Who's that?
This is Tamara.
Oh, right. Tamara. So yeah, I hadn't gotten to that part yet. So you and I met there and we had a meeting. So maybe you can say a little bit about your impression of the meeting, but it was a really vibrant meeting. And one thing that did happen, and I already put this in the chat, was that we officially nationally launched the AMS Certified Teacher Program, which is built off the courses we offer. And for those that may not know, one of the five courses we offer is for climate science for K-12 educators to raise their expertise in the foundational understanding of climate science. So the others are in weather and physical oceanography, all of which certainly relate to the earth around us and climate's impact on them. So that's how all this relates. Yeah, Tamara, what did you take away from
No, I had it. Yeah, I attended some of the, so we had some of the sessions had teachers who had engaged with students, and the students presented. So that was quite powerful. There was one group that got, this wasn't necessarily climate related, it was more weather related, but they some of the student groups wanted to start some weather clubs at their schools, and they really were able to really have that take off and model that in other schools. So the engagement around earth and atmospheric science was really great. I had a poster there on my STEM education for tomorrow's workforce, which also features the clean resources. I had a lot of engagement there at the poster session, so that was pretty exciting too. And I think that Wendy and I also had some fruitful conversations. So I was only there for one day of the meeting, so I had a rather narrow perspective.
And those students that were presenting, it's interesting, you're exactly right. They use the terminology of weather club, but that's because it's way more attractive to a kid to say weather club, but those are actually chapters, pre-college chapters of the American Meteorological Society. So we have pre-college chapters, student chapters, which are undergrad and grad school, and then full adult public chapters as well, which are all mechanisms for talking about earth science literacy, concerns, activities in local communities. That's it.
So Amy, Wendy, one other perspective on AMS. While I was not able to be there, my travel ticket couldn't handle that much travel this year. But one of my colleagues, Todd, who runs our higher education portfolio at the Climate Program Office, so our support for the AMS Graduate Fellowship Program and the SOARS Program also convenes a lot of their students there, which is significant opportunities in atmospheric research that's managed also by UCAR. Great programs, great students, really impressive young people that are coming in and carrying on the work of our previous generations and current generations in the field. So I heard a ton of energy. The room was so loud. It was more like the Chiefs game on Sunday than it was like a conference, because no one could hear each other. It was so much talking and so much engagement and work. So, but I heard very, very impressive things about this meeting. So congratulations.
The student conference was 799 attendees.
Right.
Really?
Impressive.
Well, I know that one of the comments in our session was that I think all around us were technical sessions. And the comments were that our session was much more lively, with the engagement of the students and educational aspects of climate change.
I think it depended which presenter was presenting in the moment there.
That's probably true.
What grade level were these students, Wendy?
The youngest students I saw actually present were middle school students. They were 13 years old, and they presented on work that they'd been doing related to satellite meteorology with engagement from the educators up at Madison Sims, Wisconsin, and the SSEC. And so they had direct mentorship and support from professionals in the field there. And they were so professional. But I met informally with a growing number of high school students that are making their way there, either out of just their own sheer will or support of parents, because they're exploring and interested in STEM. And one of the takeaway assignments I got from this was try to figure out if now is the right time to more formally make space for high school participation in the meeting, the same way that 19 years ago, undergraduates were not that involved in the meeting. And now I just, like I told you, their 19th annual student conference was nearly 800 students strong. And it's been at those kind of numbers for years now. And now we're starting to see this increased demand from high school science interested students that want to engage in the community. And the society, the much bigger question than for this call, but the real question is, will we bring them into the fold the same way we did with undergraduates, or do something different? Special needs for traveling with chaperones, obviously, which doubles the support cost. So there's talk of maybe looking at a weather camp model in association with the meeting. Mm-hmm. So luckily, this is the kind of work that will be done a great deal by the volunteer boards and committees of the society, and my staff will support that, as will others on the AMS staff as it begins to take shape. But the good news, I think, for our community is that what this means is that while we hear, you know, we have STEM problems, pipeline problems, there are passionately interested students and youth that are finding their way into where the professional science conversations are happening. And they're making great contributions and also arguments for inclusion in new and exciting ways. So from my position, that was all really uplifting and good news, because in the olden days, it was much easier to break in. And I think the tools and world today make it easier for these connections to get started, and then we can build on them.
Yeah, I would like to reflect on that a little bit more. The students that were there were from Massachusetts, and they were, some of them were from this weather club that they had formed. And they were able to bring 8 students this year, and that's because they're local. But they've said that they have sending at least 1 or 2 students every year when they have to travel, and you know, it costs, and then because they're young, they need the chaperone. So the cost is a real issue. So the meeting moving around, it may be worth Wendy sort of reaching out to students and wherever the meeting happens to be that year to get more students there, those AMS student chapters, to have students come when they're local.
Yeah, I think that is happening. I mean, I think that is happening, but the question is how much can the meeting support? I was joking with the incredible amount that happened in the week and everyone feeling like they needed more time. I think we may end up at a 2-week meeting, which probably isn't sustainable. So we're going to have to start leveraging even more completely other tools for community engagement, because it can't all happen in person. But everybody wants it to.
Yeah. That's true, but there's I don't know to the extent that you're doing, but AGU has a lot of virtual capabilities that may be worth looking into.
Oh yeah.
Well, we're talking about some sort of international stuff. Just putting out there again that I'll be headed to the community meeting. There's a behavior change meeting happening in March and April. Sort of tangentially related to the international stuff. Anybody has any stuff they want included?
Emily, do you think you could put together a kind of a pitch in an email to the community? Imagine, you know, there's only, say, 11 of us if you count the double counts on phones and webcams. You know, there's other people in the field that would probably have a lot to contribute to that.
Sure.
That aren't on the call today.
Yep. You got it.
Wendy, a question on the AMS conference.
Sure.
And let's see. It's a weather fest. I was interested how that went. That's something we'd love to be able to support in the future or whatever. I was kind of going through things that it's a good event. It's kind of bolstering things on climate. I looked through the exhibitor list just now, and kind of everybody was doing things on weather. So that's, which is important and great. But was there anything of making sure we can have climate and, say, resiliency to severe weather events and things like that?
I can speak to it a little. I don't actually have a lot to do with the Weatherfest event. I am aware of its history, and I know that it had a hiatus last year due to a low community response because we were in a repeat city. We brought it back for the Boston meeting for our centennial because it's the home, you know, home base of headquarters of the society. It was a very successful event, but there is no intention of doing it next year. We are going to New Orleans for the 3rd time. And our 2nd time in New Orleans was not successful, so we're not going to be having a Weatherfest in association with the meeting next year. And all the information coming from the volunteers that are engaged in that is that we're believing we're over this model of hold a big event and they're going to come to it. And the plan is to change the energy to looking into events or gathering spots where the community will already be, and bringing our meeting to them will be the focus starting in 2022. So this was sort of our last hurrah at Weatherfest, at least for a while.
No, thank you on that report. That's great. And I certainly would not argue against the go where the public is approach. That can totally more connect and put less effort into putting the event on. Please, if there are people in AMS who are interested in that and want a climate component in that, please always know we're here to help. That's our specialty.
Absolutely. I think that would be brilliant. You just need to hold on to that thought. Everyone is still face down, exhausted from this meeting. So no one's ready to talk about the next one yet, but we will.
Great. Thank you.
Wendy, did you have another announcement, or are you good?
Is that, those were the issue two things, that's popping up. Yeah, those were the two things about the meeting and the teacher certification being live, which I threw the link in the chat. So thank you. And thanks for the other contributions.
Gotcha. So there's an issue that's popping up, and I'm curious to see if this is, because it's just beyond education. But what I'm hearing from a lot of really talented young climate students is that they're graduating with amazing degrees and they cannot get a job because every climate job requires 5 years experience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 5 to 7, 5 to 7, 5 to 7, 5 to 7. Nobody's hiring 0 to 5. And so they're struggling with these great degrees, which come with some great debt. But they can't, there's nobody's hiring 0 to 5. So where do people who, you know, if we're going from education into the workforce, where do you get that experience to join the workforce? Because, you know, as we know in the climate field, our field is expanding. The demands on us are expanding, which means the staff and the personnel have to expand. So where do you just want to, we don't even have to have a solution here, but I just want to name it. At least in one recorded call that we heard it. We're listening to these young, talented students who are struggling, and they're trying to piece together 5 years experience through a number of internships, which pay pretty poorly. And so there's a structural challenge in our community. We're used to talking about structural challenges. This is a different one that I'm getting word about. So I don't know if anybody has that, echoes that. Patrick, you're coming through the field, and you know, when you have your PhD in a little while, you know, you may be experiencing that. So anyway, just wanted to flag that issue. Does that resonate with anybody?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
That's okay. You can go ahead.
Okay. So a question, Frank, just to make sure, taking that as seriously as it should be, which it should be. Mm-hmm. How about 3 or 4 examples of fields that we're speaking of, like atmospheric sciences, just because I don't want to be off base on where I'm thinking about that.
So I'm thinking about, Jim, I'll give you two examples. One, they want to get into, you know, a lot of the work where you're doing climate solutions. So you are working at a firm who are doing, you know, greenhouse gas inventories or vulnerability assessments or, you know, planning, with communities, whether it's in resilience or in, you know, decarbonizing, whatever, they're looking at every single job that's coming their way, and every single one of them have a minimum of experience of 5 years. So they're kind of scratching their head. So it's not just like people who are going to go into the atmospheric research field or, you know, become a climatologist or a researcher at a university. That I think might be in good shape. But what we're hearing is that the people who are in the more applied side are having trouble.
I want to agree with the labor issues. What I hear from my colleagues is not just the people just starting off, but a lot of people who are very experienced, especially in the communications fields, would like to be reaching out and participating more in climate related work, and they cannot get funding to do it. Internationally, I have an entire peer set who would like to be doing more and is struggling to figure out how to do that and still get paid. So I would second labor issues and expand it.
So I wanted to share an example, which probably will give a little bit of hope. There is a small utility company. It's not small anymore, but it was an energy management company. It was started in 2000, and it was started by two engineers. It's in Minnesota, but they started it to cover the energy analysis work, and it was a growing field then. Department of Energy had a few grants across the universities where they were training students in energy analysis and energy efficiency study. So these two engineers, they started this company. It was very small scale endeavor. And now I've seen the growth of that company, and they have employed and reached out interns and trained them to do energy efficiency and energy analysis work. As a company, they have paid the cost of training on job because they all are learning together. But they were able to apply to state subsidiaries because they were training on job. So they were recruiting and training. They also pay cost in that once these trainees, they kind of the shelf life of trainees is 5 to 6 years, because once they get the kind of expertise of where is energy efficiency and how it is analyzed, how do you get small contracts, they tend to become confident enough to become independent consultants or small energy auditors, reporting or taking contracts from big utilities like Xcel Energy and all. So there are costs and benefits to it, but there is something, as I've seen in the growth of the company over the years, that when you hire these people who are just entering the profession, they come with a zeal of learning and trying new ideas. They're very enthusiastic. And so I say there are ways to take that model as that company has done, and they have successfully survived more than a decade. They're doing very good. They just got bought out by another company from Chicago and California, but they still continue to expand their work in the Midwest. So I think there is a model that can be presented to the community that here's a way to engage young professionals and who are coming from engineering, non-engineering, environmental science, environmental studies, and then have this basic training and then go on in this profession. And I think we're gonna need that model with, say, climate literacy fields too. And I feel that when I apply for jobs, I go in with a very clear idea of here's what I do. And I actually have to send in a supporting document stating what is my vision and how does it fit into what their position is. It is like I describe, you have a square peg and I have I'm proposing a different thing, but your square can accommodate what I do, and it will in fact make it better. And so most of the times I am unsuccessful, but I do get the interviews and interest enough to what is this? What do you do? What is climate literacy? In fact, this week there was a webinar, Journal of Extension Engineering and Agriculture Extension, I forget the name, JAEE. They had a podcast with one of my co-authors about one of our articles that we published. And the questions one of the attendees asked was, what is climate literacy? And the person was coming from an extension and engineering background. So we are even though it feels like you all have been in this field for decades and decades and have a very clear idea of what the field entails. But to many of our hiring agencies, people, other field, they do not have an idea of what climate literacy is. So this generation, there's going to be a generation that goes out and explains, what can I do for you? And how will I make this job that you are offering a better job? Or how can I expand the possibilities of this job? So that's going to be an inherent task that we do. And accepting that kind of gives me more power and peace. That's all I had to say. Right. But the models are out there. And I think maybe we should spend some time in collecting these resources and putting them somewhere, or talking about it and documenting it. I don't know how to proceed on that. But there are models.
Thank you, Devari. That's really important. I appreciate that.
So, Frank, certainly I can be following up on this and put it into the mix of conversations. Obviously, it's going to be California, because I know there's hiring, but I can put it to people. So how much is that question of you're hiring, but you're looking for the 6 years on up people? I mean, the categories, of course, state of California, the cities. I mean, every city is required to have a climate action plan now. Now they've got a lot to do. A lot of times they're kind of faking it. I mean, there's stuff, but they need people. Private companies. I mean, one of the ways that I just know it, I can't help but know it, is we're constantly being invited to like Earth Days and events for the big corporations, you know, the you name it corporations in high tech, to come and do science things for their community, for their people, right? I mean, just for the, you know, let's have an Apple Day on climate, right? Okay. Right. Okay. So, I mean, into that, ask the questions, how do we get the younger students, or the people who are now ready for the workforce to come out? It's got to be there. But what I can say right now is I can put that into the questions. And then there's also the national labs, because the national labs are often engaged in actual solutions. Like here we have Berkeley National Laboratory, we have Lawrence Livermore Lab. They are actively engaged in climate solutions, and they've got to be hiring. So I'll look into it. And
I have something to add to James. I'm sorry. I were you done? Did I cut
yeah,
you?
Yeah. Thank you. No, good.
California, I have applied to 4 jobs in California, and extensively knowing about their climate adaptation plan. Here's my challenge. The departments or the positions that have been envisioned, honestly, it feels like they were copy-pasted from whatever they were, as they were written, say, a decade ago. Which means if there was a department that was a science and engineering department, they continue to have the requirement as a science and engineering graduate, thus not allowing room for people like me who have crossed over from science to science education, that puts us out. So it's a systemic change that's needed, that the climate adaptation plan is there. The ability to help is there. The candidate is here. But the hiring agencies, that committee, did not make room for allowing us to actually come in and share our vision. So that's the California experience that I have that I went through last year. Another experience, me being an international worker, I bring it to this platform as think of it as an equity thing. There was a position that I applied to and I got, and it was offered to me. However, in the scheme of finding a work permit for that particular position, the U.S. government doesn't have that category yet, because we're still in the primitive stages of those categories where they're pretty black and white. So for example, you have researcher, all kinds of researcher go in that box. Then you have educator, all kinds of educators go in that box. Anyone who is in the transitional phase, or their work goes between research and education, are not fitting in that box. Those are the categories that were decided by immigration, say, more than 30 years ago. So again, I lose on that job because the categories were not, you can't make them clear. I do both. I do science literacy education and I do research. One informs the other. So we are at a very interesting point in the growth of this field, where we have the ability to inform not only the field itself, but also the systemic change that comes with it. So not only this field creates jobs, but then we have to figure out how to hire these people to do these jobs. Now, see it as a challenge or see it as opportunity, but seeing it as opportunity gives me hope. So let's stick with that side of the equation. So.
I appreciate that. That's really important. That's an important little detail to remember. Sometimes if you don't remember which cog in the machine is actually not working, you forget that it still needs to be fixed. So I heard you loud and clear. That's an important point. Especially because those transitional fields. I mean, I think, you know, and I don't know if California's gotten this yet, but I mean, we in this community realize that they just need to know the science. Just let them have more science. Let's translate that science better. I mean, you know, I'm looking at the social and behavior change communications community portal. And I mean, I think we know better now than we did back in 2008-09 mm-hmm. about how this information works into communities and social behavior changes. Just to bring it back to Vardy, that other point, when I was buying a new heat pump to replace my system, I had to convince the installers and the companies that I did not want any more natural gas being used in my house. I had to convince them to sell me non-fossil fuel based heating and cooling. And, you know, so those people in the HVAC community, they're educators. They're not, you know, we talked about this at AGU in one of the workshops that, you know, who are the unconventional educators? And, you know, those heating and cooling people are going to have to be really good at talking with people about electrifying everything. And why it works and is better for your climate concerns simultaneously, but that doesn't happen by accident at all. So I'm right with you.
I have a lot of those conversations, Frank. Thanks for bringing that up. I'm wondering, do we have any partnerships yet with any of those professional guilds?
Not yet. I mean, I've not seen that yet, but I mean, other partners may have been doing that to date.
Okay.
I mean, kind of no problem on, I can certainly help to do that. I mean, as what I do as a climate educator, I'm more focusing on K-12 and university toward that, but certainly have the ties, have the connections. I mean, from an engineering standpoint, you also have to know well the unions and the different fields. So we have HVAC who traditionally take it all, and now you're going to fold in more of the electrical union who has to power up everything, right? So I mean, yeah, I mean that's, but where people want connections, no problem. We can get people introduced on that. That's now I think that's a little in terms of the specific. I mean, so absolutely right, and that's important. Is I think we're talking about professions that are coming through the university level. I mean that's almost always those are people who leave high school and get into apprenticeship and they go that direction. So, I mean, they're sort of stretched out as soon as they leave high school. Now, of course, people are going to university and then beat the trades, but it tends to be we who are engineers went the university level and then there's the trades people, but we need both. I mean, Frank, you're absolutely right. It's like if the trades, the contractors are resisting going all electric, that's a real problem. And, it's a current issue in San Francisco and in the California. San Francisco just announced that no buildings can be built anymore with natural gas. So, but making it happen, it's one thing to make a policy. It's another thing to make it happen.
And also, Jim, remember only 35% of people in the nation get an advanced degree. 35% in the United States. So I mean, 65% of our high school students are graduating and going either into the associate's program and getting a technical certification or joining the workforce and then getting like you've already, you were saying, getting on the job training. That's not a huge percentage. So they should be a big part of our focus. We're thinking about, you know, 100% climate literacy. Right. Sorry, Pat.
Patrick. Yeah. No, and let's see. On the going the trades route of the installers, the people who put it in, the people who inspect it, all that. Those are fields that almost universally, in at least in the states where people are going for dealing with climate change, it's kind of odd how it's the states that tend to resist it, where this may not be the case, but they can't get enough people. I mean, they can't get enough people who are getting $150,000 a year, and they've just started. I mean, after 5 years of apprenticeship, easily less years than you have to do at the university level, they're making that kind of money. I mean, and they can't get enough people. So, I mean, it's like in that area, it's just get people know where to look to get into that direction, because it's there. Now, you know, there's a lot of, anyway, that's a very reality. The HVAC, the electricians, they cannot get enough people, union jobs.
So I want to throw a couple things in the mix. One is that I think questions like these are very well suited for the project we hope to embark on this year, mapping that climate literacy landscape, because we all have our own experiences, assumptions, and understandings of our particular areas, but taking a look at the broader landscape to see, well, are there any places this is working well? If so, where? What does it look like? How does it move forward? If there are actually no places that are working well, what would it take to move that system? What resources and what places? And is there a desire for it? Just looking at these openings and possibilities, I think this is the exact type of thing that, rather than talk around as much as I see this, I think this, I believe this, this would be very useful to do in a more systematic analysis as we embark on this work this year. Because for me, like I could throw out three things on the topic. And, you know, the first is, like, I saw NCAR fire all their social scientists last year. And that's a hell of a statement to make about values of who you're hiring and who you're not. In the college system, I see that a program like environmental studies and in many universities is very much not job oriented. Like, an engineer goes engineering, teacher teaches, environmental studies student studies environmental things, you know, and it's like there's very little job focus on there, and it actually means very little to have that degree. The only way it has meanings is if you know exactly what areas you can offer. Kind of as Devrati was saying, you have to be able to market yourself. And that marketing is a combination of students learning how to do it and colleges providing support through networks and connections. But again, that's just my perspective. I think it would be very interesting to take that, throw it into the mix, and test all of these ideas that we have against what's actually happening nationwide to see if they hold true across the system. And if there's places where they're not, what's happening there?
Thank you, Patrick. This is one last week we've sent an abstract to a conference, Natural Resource Education Conference in Montana, and describing an environmental education class that allows students to gain certification while in class. So the students get Project Wild, Project Wet, and a couple other certifications. And that was a model that we're trying to implement here. But this, again, was the idea, because students are lost, environmental education students at least, as to there are so many things where they fit and yet they do not fit. And they lose those jobs to other qualifications, or someone had a cool internship, they lost it. So hence these certifications were very much appreciated by the students. But to get them in the course and to develop a course like that took a lot of effort, almost about 2 years for the instructor to implement it. So we have a lot to contribute to your formal investigation, or whenever you put together that meeting.
So I think, Devardi, you know, the talking it all the way through to actionable prioritization, you know, like this is important and this is important and they relate to each other in these ways. I think, you know, it's interesting how our conversations have changed over the years. It's too bad Tamara had to drop off because, you know, I mean, she was part of the original conversations and, you know, early 2009, we didn't talk like this. Not even close. And I think how our field has evolved in our thinking and our strategic purpose and our differentiation and thereby able to focus and prioritize is just remarkable. So sorry, that's just a moment of reflection.
No, that was an excellent reflection, because that was my question. In case we did not have anything to talk about, I was going to pose that question. I had noticed that there were founding members here. I was going to pose that question. So good thing that you end with that. And I think that should be another separate informal conversation. I think Emily had brought up this last time or a couple times ago, that how has this evolved the field from your perspective, your guys' perspective. We want to hear that some other day. And think it's time.
We should do that.
Almost 2 minutes left, but that should be another formal, informal conversation, I think. Anything other that someone wants to share? We have 1 minute left.
I have a 1 minute thing. We are getting ready to, we just finished our new version of our Youth Climate Summit Planet Yourself Toolkit. And I just wanted to seek some ideas in terms of dissemination or networks where you think that might, it's totally free. You just we have new web pages, we have this new toolkit, we have all these resources for other places around the world that can want to start youth climate summits. And we've done a lot of updating from our old toolkit. And I'm just looking for ideas in for dissemination.
Jen, one way to do it is to submit to the Doha Work Program and weave in a recommendation as a dissemination possibility for summits worldwide, something like that, because that goes through the official channels and then raises the visibility. I think they already have some visibility, but they may not realize the replicability potential.
Okay, thanks, Frank. I was planning on submitting, so that was one thing on my checklist.
Gotcha.
Obviously through the clean community, but I just, you know, there's a lot of networks out there and a lot of different networks that might connect with teachers, students, agencies, civil societies, and different nonprofit groups in like really different ways. And I'm trying to think a little outside the normal box.
Mm-hmm. What about the Parent Teachers Association?
Well, that's a good one.
If I remember right, there's a national and then there's state levels and there's lots of structure there that might be something to leverage. Looks like Devardi, we were blowing past our time here.
Sorry.
Our time is up, but I do not have answer to your question. If you need to chat with Jen, then I don't know how to facilitate that. Do I have the power to do that, Matt Patrick?
I am not sure. I think we make Frank the facilitator. That's what you do.
Oh, okay. We give Frank the power.
We can drop off, yep.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll bring it up at the next call. Oh, but I guess we're cutting off. Yeah. But if anyone has any ideas, just email. You could maybe email me.
Just follow up with Jen if you have an idea.
I can't give Frank the power. He doesn't have the options to.
It's Devardi. It's okay. We'll let's pick it up in a subsequent chat.
There you go. I think I got it to you, Frank. But yeah, I'd like to take that subject up again. And I think what would be helpful around that is learning what's been done so far so we can give the most useful advice.
Yeah, we haven't done anything yet. And sure. I also think it might be helpful just in general because there are so many great resources that all of our you know, clean members and clean community has. Like, I think, you know, we just really rely on people going to the clean website to find it. And oftentimes, so I feel like that amplification of all the incredible resources that the community offers, like, you know, it would be interesting to think about that, you know, maybe in another informal conversation, because I just think that there's so much that this group could leverage and help to connect those resources across a bunch of different sectors. So.
Network mapping, we should do it.
Network mapping. Emily, thanks for that suggestion. I'll